Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on Smooth, our CFRU.
That was so smooth.
It was smooth. I was going for something else, but oh well. CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson.
I'm Candace LePage.
Yeah, so that happened. Let's move on. We'll just chalk it up to the end of an all-encompassing election period, which we were just talking about off air.
Yes, yeah.
This isn't a political show.
But it might end up being.
Because of the review?
I don't know.
All right, we'll see.
We'll see.
End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror comedy sequel, Zombieland Double Tap. Full of raw politics there. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including trailers. We've got Fox, we've got dogs, we've got all the other animals. And then Candace will take her turn to reveal her top five of 1999. Not sure what she's got, but I'm going to lay money down now that Big Daddy probably isn't on her list.
That's a good guess.
Unlike other people
Nothing
we can name.
Nothing against Big Daddy, which was a very fun movie.
Well, you can debate that with Peter next week. But first, it looks like Matrix 4 is happening, which I have mixed feelings about. But it is interesting to know what they kind of have in the cooker for this. I'm getting out my notes. So basically, in August, Warner Brothers and Village Roadshow, who made the first three Matrix movies, greenlit the project. Lana Wachowski is co-writing, directing, and producing, but without her sister Lily, who is focusing on different projects. David Mitchell, who is a novelist, and Alexander Harmon, who is a literary critic, but worked with the Wachowskis on Sense8, their Netflix show, are going to be co-writing the script. Mitchell, interestingly enough, wrote the novel Cloud Atlas, which the Wachowskis made a movie of, and not a universally acclaimed movie, but an interesting movie, an interesting experiment, I would say. Yaka Abdul-Mateen, Jessica Henwick, and Neil Patrick Harris are the stars who have signed on. Keanu Reeves, Carrie Ann Moss, and Jada Pinkett Smith are returning.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my first blush at any of these things is like, why? You know, it's like, it's 20 years since the original Matrix, but like 16 years since the sequels, which were not universally well received.
Yeah, so I think that's part of the reason why. So
do over.
Yeah, I think spoilers for my top five of 99. So the original Matrix film was quite a good film, and was had a lot going on in it, and did a lot for society. Now, knowing that both Lily and Lana Wachowski are transgendered, and were transgendered then, just obviously living different lives. First of all, rewatching the original Matrix, there's so much more there retroactively. You're like, oh, here we thought it was, you know, a film about a Jesus, like a savior type thing. And actually it was a film about being who you are.
Yeah.
Right? You can actually look at it again. So now it's interesting to me that at least one of them is going to revisit this with a more... I don't like using the word honest, because it's not that they were lying.
That's not their
previously
intent, yeah.
But with a more and I hate the use authentic but you know what I'm trying to say, right? Like, as she is retelling or going back to a story that was already about her being who she was.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of interest. I think that's part of the reason why, because now we can look back at the film and understand what it was actually about, and then now see what it's like now that she is who she is.
And a lot has been written too, sorry to interrupt, but a lot has been written about the character of Switch in the original one, that the original idea with that character was that she was female in the quote-unquote real world, but she imagined herself as male, as a him, inside the Matrix. But even that was like a bridge too far.
Yeah, for... 99. Nobody was ready for that. And I think, too, the two other films, I think maybe partially because maybe the Wachowskis themselves didn't entirely know what they were making and how they felt and who they were either, so didn't mm-hmm. recognize... you know, in the first film, what they were saying. Mm-hmm. And so the second and third film, even at the time and looking back now, nobody really knows what they're about. I don't think the Wachowskis even knew what they were about. And they were rushed because the original Matrix was so good. Everybody wanted more. Mm-hmm. And so they made more and they just didn't really work because they hadn't put in so much thought and time and philosophy and thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it, too, is that the expectation for sequels is that you want the same but more.
Yeah.
And that's not what you get in the Matrix sequels. You get this, like, more tangled web of, like, it goes deeper into the idea of what is real mm-hmm. by pulling on the thread that Neo is not the one. He has been the latest in a series of ones in this circular pattern where they build Zion up, they take Zion down, and it goes on like this. And I don't think people were prepared for and I think the Wachowskis have done this since, when you're talking about Cloud Atlas, whether you're talking about Jupiter Ascending, these projects that have a lot of really interesting ideas, perhaps not executed as well as they could, but I still find them interesting. I still mm-hmm. I've watched Jupiter Ascending since it first came out, and it's a very enjoyable. The Michael Giacchino soundtrack kicks ass.
Well, how could it not, really?
But, well, he's not always great. But, I mean...
I'm sorry, have you watched the Transformers movies?
I don't think he scores those.
Are you sure?
I think Steve Jablonski is the
scorer. Oh, yeah, you're right.
But leaving that
either
aside...
Way, his scores are good.
But, I mean, the score for Jupiter Ascending is so great. And mm-hmm. Cloud Atlas, they said was unfilmable. Well, you could film it. Could you film it well? Debatable, but they still did it. It was yeah. still made. And I think that, you know, they were sort of like the last of a brand who were able to, like, convince a studio to give them millions and millions of dollars to take really bold chances. And it could be right. Like, it could be like 20 years later, there's a really great kernel of an idea there that, you know, they can realize the vision perhaps as they saw fit. Or maybe it's something where... You know, Lana, I think it's Lana, that's, mm-hmm. yeah, Lana, yeah. that, you know, you do get an idea years later. I mean, look at Margaret Atwood with The Testament, you know.
Mm-hmm.
you can follow up years later yeah. and follow up successfully. And it'll be interesting to see because I remember I think it was 2017, they started talking about Zach Penn. Zach Penn is one of these screenwriters, and, you know, he seems like a nice guy, and he's done some good work, but, I mean, he's also one of these guys who's just... He's so entrenched in geek culture, and that's so mm-hmm. his brand that you just staple him to something and yep. you know, you get down with it. But if it's something like that, where it was like rumored, it was like Young Morpheus Adventures in the Matrix. No, I don't. No, thank you. That's mm-hmm. fine. But this is the Matrix itself is this really interesting world. And I think one of the things I'll point to is the Animatrix.
Oh, my gosh. That anthology. That was great.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't all great, but there are ones like... I can't remember what it was called, but it was about the Olympic runner who, like, mm-hmm. through sheer force of endurance and human excellence, is able to glimpse the Matrix as he's running this race, as he's running this 10-second yeah. race, and it's such this amazing little thing. Or the one where it talks about the origins of the Matrix. I mean, mm-hmm. there are so many interesting knobs and directions that you could go to that I'm willing to see, because it is actually going to camera. It's going to camera in February, so.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, even though the second and third ones were not as good,
mm-hmm.
there were still, you know, there were good things in them.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, I enjoy the whole series, including the Animatrix.
The climactic fight at the end of Matrix Revolutions between, mm-hmm. you know, Smith and Neo, it's awesome.
I haven't actually seen it because it has so much strobe effect that I have to close really? My eyes when it's happening. I understand it's raining,
but it's like it's raining so heavy because it's like meant to evoke like the Matrix code.
Yeah, because it's all green,
it's yeah. yeah, but I mean it's such a like a finely detailed thing. It's mm-hmm. Which I you know makes them such exciting filmmakers, so that they do watch the details.
Mm-hmm. And I'm excited for Neil Patrick Harris to be in it.
I don't know what, like, he's
I think he is such a versatile actor. He can do comedy. Right. He can do drama. You know, he can do all sorts of things. And I do find it interesting that in this article, it was a Variety Fair, I think, or Vanity Fair, that, you know, said, this is his first foray into a sci-fi franchise. I'm like, hello, did nobody watch Starship Troopers?
Well, nobody who writes for Vanity Fair. Maybe. But no, I mean, that was the interesting thing. I mean, he's been known as, like, the host guy. He hosted the Tonys for years. He hosted the Oscars once. But he's been, you know, I guess since How You Met Your Mother, he's been known for that like, sort of larger-than-life character. And he came out since then, too. But, I mean, yeah, if you go back and look at Starship Troopers, when he's, like, actually much more baby-faced, he's still kind of, like, in the Doogie Howser phase, but he's, like, playing, like, the ultimate, like, when he comes out at the end in the, literally the SS gear.
Yeah,
it could be interesting. It could be interesting.
Yeah, plus his role in Gone Girl, too.
Oh, yeah,
was
yeah.
so good. So he can play.
He can play against type. The type he constructed, but he can undermine it. Okay. Let's talk about the trailers. So there was Doolittle, which stars Robert Downey Jr. as...
Doolittle. As the titular character.
As the titular Doolittle. Lady and the Tramp, which is a remake of the Disney... animated film, and Bombshell, which is about the ousting of Roger Ailes at Fox News, although unlike, I think the loudest voice was kind of very much from the Ailes perspective, which I guess you do when you hire Russell Crowe to be Roger Ailes, but this seems to be very much from the point of view of the women at Fox News. So you have A Murderer's Row with Charlize Theron as Megyn Kelly, Nicole Kidman as Gretchen Carlson, and Margot Robbie, who doesn't play like an actual person, but plays like a composite of, of characters. So, I mean, this is kind of us getting into the political here.
A little bit. But do you know what? I was hooked by the trailer. I think it looks great. I really want to see it. I haven't watched... many of the sort of political movies that have come out in the last, I don't know, roughly 10 years or so. potentially just because I'm, you know.
It's your day job.
Yeah. I'm already there. It's fine. I don't need to do it.
Right.
But yeah, this looks really interesting, well done. I like the fact that it's sort of more from the women's point of view. It's only remotely creepy that they all look exactly alike. And it took me until about 2 minutes into the trailer to figure out which one was which.
I mean, that's like kind of the Fox
News. That's the point, I know.
Right. It's, you know, the... I do like the beginning where Kate McKinnon is, like, I think she's supposed to be a producer or something. Mm-hmm. She says, like, this is Fox News. We do things that scare your grandmother and make your grandfather angry. And it's like, well, that's kind of the point. And then the other side of it, too, is that it's the women who are on Fox. Not that, you know, other women in TV news aren't in hair and makeup and, you know, well-dressed. But, I mean, with Fox, it's specifically noticeable that...
they're all
it's sex
sells.
Yeah. Sex sells on Fox. And, you know, when you understand that Roger Ailes was like a 10th level pervert and sexual harasser, it sort of makes the more sense. It does. The director is Jay Roach, who's done a lot of really great political films on HBO, like The Recount and Game Change. So although also being known for Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery. But, you know, he knows his stuff, and I think he knows how to find like a fine line between telling what I hope is like a very human story, but at the same time, everyone at Fox News is horrible. So, also horrible, Doolittle. And I was listening to a podcast. I think it was one of the Collider podcasts, and somebody pointed out it's like they use "It's a Wonderful World" in the trailer, but they don't use the Dr. Doolittle song.
Yeah.
There's already a Dr. Doolittle song.
Yeah, everything about this is so weird. It's like, oh, you love Tim Burton? We can do that too. To begin with.
And to think it's Steve Gagan, the director of Traffic. Or the writer of Traffic, I should say. Steven Soderbergh. Oh, shoot, where's Vince? the writer of Traffic.
He'll be writing in, I'm sure.
Oh, well, he's here next week, so we'll hear about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, the movie's not for me. Let's just say that. The movie is not for me.
It's being released in January, so I'm not sure it's for anyone.
Oh, could have been released in February, which is even worse. Then it'd be up against three other horror films.
Yeah, well, It's interesting because the backstory is that, you know, there was like a 3 weeks of reshoots.
Did they reshoot? It's all CGI.
I know. Well, it's bizarre because, you know, it's Jonathan Liebsman, who did the Ninja Turtles, one of the most recent Ninja Turtles movies, mm-hmm. you know, helped out. And it's just like, it's one of these things that's like, who is this for? Who's clamoring for a new Dr. Doolittle?
Yeah.
And it's like Robert Downey Jr., you spent 10 years playing Iron Man, and like your first like is like, give me another franchise. I don't know why I'm saying this in a Patrick Stewart voice, but he's like, bring me another franchise. I want to play another character. And it's just like he's doing, you know, it's Iron Man shtick, but it's Dr. Doolittle. And that's
right
fine.
Down to the part where he's in an iron suit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, you know, yeah. You know, do you remember Chaplin? Bob, do you remember Chaplin? Mm. Do you remember... Mm. Like, let's not even go that far. Do you remember U.S. Marshals?
Yeah. Robert Downey Jr. I don't, yeah, no. Also, I did notice at the end, just mm-hmm. Like four screens in a row of mm-hmm. names of like famous people who are in this film. And I was like, oh, I suppose they're voicing all the animals.
And nailed
like,
it.
Remember when voice actors used to get work? And yeah. Now they don't because yeah. Now they just hire actors. For it instead.
Yeah. Jim Cummings needs to eat. Frank Welker needs to eat. Come on. That brings us to Lady and the Tramp, which is being remade, gracefully leaving out the racist Siamese cats.
Oh, I forgot about them. It's been a while since I've watched that movie.
That seems to be the point of all these is like, we're going to remake these shot for shot and then cut out the racism.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but I mean, Kiersey Clemons and Thomas Mann play the humans who own Lady. Mm-hmm. Kiersey Clemons is a woman of color. Thomas Mann is a white man.
Mm-hmm.
They're having a marriage and a relationship in what looks like the 1920s South.
Yeah. It was it South or was it sort of like colonial India?
Oh, jeez. Well...
I don't know.
Could go either way. The steamboat with the paddles at the back, you know, it made me think of...
Okay, yeah.
And everyone was speaking English, too, so I thought, you know...
Yeah, either
chances
way,
are.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting that we kind of erase the racism, but we kind of, you know, put the blinders on about, you know, and it's too, you know, it's going to suffer from the Lion King problem, which is like you have the photorealistic animals who can't emote.
Mm-hmm.
And all you're left with is like they got famous voices. Tessa Thompson is Lady, Justin Theroux is the Tramp. And it's like, well, okay, fine. Congratulations. Except this one isn't even being released in theaters. It's going to Disney Plus.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that. For streaming. Well, and maybe, thankfully, we'll be saved. By Disney Plus, and all of these, the rest of these remakes will all go to streaming only.
I think that's $1.5 billion worth of hopeful thinking there, but we'll leave that for another time. We're going to come right back with Candace's top five of 1999. But first, we're going to blast the Master of Puppets. You're listening to CFRU, home of Metallica!
Ourselves.
What?
Think about it, you guys. What would Brian Boitano do? He'd figure out a way to rescue Terrence and Phillip before they're executed.
We can't do anything. Our mom's organization is too strong.
Well, then we'll round up all the grounded kids in town and start our own organization. An organization to help save Terrence and Phillip.
Hey, yeah, our own secret club.
I guess that could work.
We have to try. What would Brian Boitano do if he was here right now? He'd make a plan and he'd follow through. That's what Brian Boitano do.
When Brian Boitano was in the Olympics skating for the gold, he did two stout cows and a triple lutz while wearing a blindfold.
When Brian Boitano was in the Alps fighting friendly bears. He used his magical fire breath and saved the maidens there. So what would Brian Boitano do if he were here today? I'm sure he'd kick an ass or two. That's what Brian Boitano do.
Brian Boitano, famous for kicking bear ass in the Alps.
Yes, I often ask myself, when faced with a decision, what would Brian Boitano do? Actually, I ask, what would Elvis Stoiko do?
That's the Canadian version. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that was a clip from South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. It has been out of two lists so
Spoiler
far.
Spoiler alert, it is not on my list.
Oh, that's too bad. We were setting up a
scheme. I could swap something here out. I just don't know what.
All right. Well, let's start with your... Do we want to start 5?
Yes, I'll start at 5. I'll start at 5 because okay. I actually have 6 and I couldn't... I was just like, how? What? Which one of these moves? But so when you said, well, is there a tie? And I said, okay, I can put 2 things at number 5.
All right.
That are... not as important or something. One being, the first film by a director who I quite like, and the other one being maybe the first, like, very big pop culture moment by a director mm-hmm. that I quite like, and that's The Sixth Sense mm. and Dogma.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, Kevin Smith, to me, so I used to want to be a director, and I had sort of a list of 3 directors who I really liked who were auteurs. They, you know, wrote their own stuff, directed their own stuff, mm-hmm. Being Kevin Smith, Quentin Tarantino, mm-hmm. and Bruce McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
So when Dogma came out, I was already well on board the Kevin Smith train, like well on board. I'd been watching things since I rented Clerks at the video rental store.
And the what?
The video rental store. Oh. It's a place you used to go to where you could take these boxes off shelves and then go to the front and then they would give you a videotape of the box.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
There's some kids in the hallway who are probably like, what?
Video. Yeah. So Dogma was like this huge, you know, it was kind of like the first time that Hollywood, mainstream Hollywood, was really sort of paying attention to him. Who knows why before, like he'd been, you know, sort of an indie darling. And then mm-hmm. he was actually given like, okay, yeah, we're going to like, let's make a big movie with you. Oh, you want to make it about God? Well, some people are going to have a problem with that.
Oh, some people did.
Yeah. So arguably most people think that this is actually one of his worst films.
Mm.
I think those people have not seen Tusk, but which to be fair, I haven't seen Tusk either.
I have. And yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, hometown boy does good. He was given a shot and he went for it. And, you know, some people got on board and some people didn't.
The thing I love about Dogma is that there was like protests outside. I think it was at the Sundance screening or maybe mm-hmm. it was on one of the early screenings. Yep. And so Kevin Smith went out and joined the protest.
Was a protester. Yeah.
It was kind of hilarious.
Yeah. And then The Sixth Sense, of course, yeah. being the very first film by M. Night Shyamalan. And, you know, this is one of those films where it was a real sleeper hit. And I think that the buzz about it helped a lot because I had no interest in seeing it. I saw the trailer. I was like, meh, whatever. It looks like a, you know, not quite a horror film, kind of a thriller. I wasn't really into seeing thrillers at the theater. You know, it's not like I was going to see What Lies Beneath at the... So...
Mm-hmm.
But then someone told me what the twist was.
Oh, really?
And I went, well, that's interesting. Huh. And that's actually what got me to the theater to see it. I was not interested prior to knowing what the twist was. And while some people certainly are like, oh, it was great. And then the twist. And oh, my God, it was so good. I really liked knowing the twist going in. I still, like, even knowing the twist, I still couldn't see the pieces until it happened, which I think is a real sign of a job well done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I even went in knowing the twist.
Mm-hmm.
But until that sort of reveal of we see all these scenes, and I go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I remember being in line to go into that, and there were people in front of me talking about, like, it's, you know, this is the twist. And I was like, because I was like that. Yeah. And I went because I heard there was a twist.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I want to see what this marvelous twist is. And it was actually rather marvelous. Anyway, mm-hmm. Number four.
Yeah. Number four. Let's go with, so these are not really in an order, but let's go with Fight Club.
Oh, yeah. I think this is the first Fight Club.
I know. I'm surprised. No, I was sure this was going to be on someone's list because I don't know if you've noticed, but your other co-hosts are men and I'm a woman. And if you've seen Fight Club, you will know.
Now that you mention it.
You will know that Fight Club is actually about disaffected men not understanding their place in society now that we are, and to be fair, in 1999, we weren't really that far down the line. But,
no.
You know, we were really working hard on building a more sort of inclusive society and mm-hmm. more gender parity
mm-hmm.
Without really addressing the when someone else has more, it doesn't mean you have less.
Right.
So, you know, I think...
Life is not a pie.
It's not. It's not a pie. But so, you know, when I saw this film, because I was a person who came to feminism very late in life and mm-hmm. really struggled with that whole thing where I was just like, but women aren't better than men. We don't deserve more than men. You know, I was very much one of those people who couldn't understand. I saw a feminism not as equality, but as women are better.
Yeah.
And I did not take to that. And so I really came to this film watching it going, yeah, see, this is one of the problems we have now where we're not, and I still think that is a problem, and we see it in a lot of things, where we're just not addressing now what men's roles are and can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that Fight Club necessarily did it very well because they still made it all about violence.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's all that men are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we actually have to do is try to find ways for men to understand their emotions
yeah.
without violence.
Right.
But, yeah. And then similarly, of course, there was a twist, which,
mm-hmm.
You know, I saw this movie three times in short order. And the next couple of times I saw it, I was like, it was so obvious.
Yeah.
It was so obvious, and yet...
And it's been copied so much now.
Well,
too.
Yeah, now. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it
Mr. Robot.
Yeah. So, I think that it's just a really well-made film.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
And Ed Norton, can we have that guy back?
Well, he's got Motherless Brooklyn coming out next month.
Excellent. I'll be watching that.
All right. Number three.
I'm going to go with 10 Things I Hate About You.
Oh, I think Peter and I were wondering if that was going to make the cut.
Yeah, it was really tough. So I was surprised when I looked at 99. So I graduated from high school technically in 95, though I went back for some extra credits. So in 99, I was, you know, in my
still
20s.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. And
the math checks out.
Yeah. I was like, how old was that? Like, you know, I didn't go to university or college, but most of my friends were. We were outside of high school. And so I was surprised looking back at how many of those films that I really enjoyed that are like high school films were mm-hmm. still coming out in 99. I had sort of thought that they were earlier, more like, you know, 96, 97 type films. So I was just like, wow, this really was still a high point for those 90s teen films. And
yeah.
I think in a way 99, and I didn't put American Pie on my list because I don't need to because someone else already did, but because I could sort of address it in this, because I think, you know, 10 Things I Hate About You versus American Pie show the two different, like there was
yeah.
a split right there where we stopped having the films of the 90s where everybody was so clever. They were so much smarter than they were. They're sarcastic. They're talking like college graduates.
right. The Williamson effect.
Yeah. And then suddenly, you know, we go into American Pie and everything is a lot more sort of gross out comedy, which I think has had a significant effect as, you know, you were talking about last week,
yeah.
right? Like it just opened the door to all these other things.
Yeah.
But 10 Things I Hate About You, of all of those, I think is even higher bar than a lot of the films that were coming out, as many films that are actually just based on old stories like Clueless, 10 Things I Hate About You, right? This was the
Cruel Intentions.
Cruel Intentions as well, right? But 10 Things I Hate About You is the Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah.
Also, for many people, the first time they saw Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
And, you know, what he really, like, he shone on screen. He really, really did. And you could sort of understand. And even though he's sort of like a jerk.
Yeah.
you really just fall in love with him.
He's on. Yeah, he was kind of a. I understand that Heath Ledger is an attractive man, but I mean, he was also had a very unconventional mm-hmm. leading man quality to him, especially in that role where he's not like he doesn't have swagger and he's just kind of a brute. And
And also Julia Stiles again too.
Oh, she is great. Yeah,
I just want more Julia Stiles all the time. She's great.
She didn't get a lot to do in Hustlers, which was too bad.
I know. I haven't got a chance to see that. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt. His cast is really, you know.
Good cast. Yeah, for sure. So that brings us to number two.
Okay, so these last two, I had to decide which way to do it. And I'm going to go with, so I'm going to put The Matrix as number two, even though it was arguably a better film than what I have at number one.
Interesting. Okay.
But, so The Matrix and 10 Things I Hate About You also opened on the same day, apparently.
Didn't they?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So The Matrix, I mean, we've already talked about it a little bit, but at the time, it was really, you know, we were going into digital and tech and stuff like that, and we were just on the cusp of, you know, what we thought was going to be the future, AI and all this sort of stuff. As it turns out, of course, we were so far away from that.
That's right.
But so it was really the right time for that, as we were still, you know, and we were just about to, we had Y2K looming.
Yeah.
Right? Everything is going to, like, totally change next year. And
ask your parents about Y2K.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That was so long ago. I can't even believe.
I mean, yeah, there were kids. The kids out in the hallway. Don't remember Y2K.
They've always lived.
Before they were born.
Oh, my God. wow, I think I don't have much more to say about this movie now anymore. Oh, my God.
What I will add about it is, like, it was part of, like, a fad of, like, VR movies. About, like,
Johnny Mnemonic.
Johnny Mnemonic, but also in the same year, Existence came out 13 Floors. 13 Floors was produced by Roland Emmerich, so you can imagine what that one was like. And then you have Existence, which was directed by David Cronenberg, and it is super Cronenbergian.
We've got a cerebral one and a big loud boom one.
Right, and then in the middle you have The Matrix, which kind of surfs the wave of the two, where it's both philosophical, but it's also awesome action.
It was. And I think some people would sort of argue, like people would say, oh, this was like a Keanu Reeves turning point or like a comeback, except that he didn't have anything to come back from. He was always consistently working, but I think people had really, you know, in the 90s, he tried some different things and tried some things that were a little more drama.
Yeah.
And people made fun of him for it.
Right.
And in some cases, maybe rightly so. Maybe you should have just not bothered with the accent and just played it straight in Dracula, because I do think that he can play a dramatic role.
Do the Costner.
I think he could have, but, you know, so I think he came out here in The Matrix and people were like, oh, yeah, Keanu Reeves, he's back. I was like, well, he's not back. He's not back from anything. He's a very successful movie star right now.
He hits these
point.
Like things, it seems like, every 10 years where, Bill and Ted in 89, you have The Matrix in 99. I can't think of anything in, like, 2009. But, like, in this year, you have John Wick and you have, you know, him going back to Bill and Ted. And he's in Toy Story 4 doing the voice. And, you know, so he's having a moment.
He's having a renaissance.
He has this, he comes in waves.
A Keanu-sance.
There's a Keanu wave effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, number one.
Number one. It's such a trope, such a meme to hate on this movie, but it was absolutely the most rewarding experience I had in a movie theater in that year and probably in a lot of years, and that was The Phantom Menace.
Okay. No, fair enough.
So I grew up, Star Wars was everything.
Oh, yeah.
Everything. I still, to this day, own all of the toys that I owned in 1977. I've got Ewok Village. I've got Millennium Falcon. I've got the little Darth Vader carrying case. I've got all of the action figures. I still own all of those things. I own all of the books, the original novelizations from the films, the read-alongs with the record players.
Oh, my God.
Like, pop-out, like, books. Star Wars was everything. Yeah. Everything. I'm those people. I read the entire expanded universe. I could have told you anything about any, like, I had all the games, everything. So the fact that there was going to be a new Star Wars was monumental.
It was huge.
It was huge. It was so important.
It was everywhere, too.
And that trailer was just, like, mind-blowing. I watched it over and over and over again. My computer for many, many years, and I wish that I could make it do it again. But I have a Mac, so I can't change the opening sound. But when I had a PC...
That's Steve Jobs for you.
When my computer would load up, that Windows starting sound was the THX theme. The broom. And it's just like, so it was so important to go see this movie. And not only that, I went with my entire family and my best friend at the time, Kate, and we had been friends for years, and we went to like all of the 97 films. And in fact, we continued to go see all of the Star Wars films together, myself and Kate. So there was like 8 of us there. My mom, my dad, my brother, me, my cousin, my aunt, both of my cousins, my best friend. And like, I think I cried through the whole thing. And not because of any parts of the movie, but just because of how important it was. And, you know, I stand by the fact that the movie is not as bad as people say it is.
No, I don't think so.
There are definitely problems with Jar Jar Binks. There's definitely problems with the CGI being still not as up to snuff as George Lucas wanted it to be. And we all know George Lucas has troubles directing cast. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and there are people who could have probably put in better performances if they had a different director, but the movie is not as bad as...
Still has the best lightsaber fight.
Oh my gosh, yes, that ending, with Darth Maul, and the best music. Soundtrack, the music is so good. Yeah,
yeah, it's worth revisiting, I think. So that's Candace's top 5. We will hear Vince's top 5 next week, and I don't know if I'll do mine next week too, or maybe the week after, we'll see. So much to do, so little time. Anyway... Wrong About the Rain? Well, that's up to Sandra Perry to tell us, because that's the music. And then we will go right to our Zombieland review. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Oh my god, I'm so sorry. I thought you were a...
You thought I was a zombie?
Yeah, of course, a zombie.
Oh my god, no, I don't even eat meat. I'm a vegetarian. Vegan, actually.
Sorry. Hi, I'm Columbus.
Madison.
Hi.
Oh my god, nice to meet you.
Oh, all right, we're hugging. So soon. Nice to meet you.
Nice to touch a human.
Don't mind me.
Oh, hello. Can I just, if I can have my body? Hi, sorry, this is Tallahassee. This is Madison. Madison Tallahassee.
Is this your dad?
Slightly older. Better-looking friend.
Yeah.
You live here?
No, Paul Blart. I live in the freezer in Pinkberry. It keeps the zombies out, though it is awfully chilly.
That is a clip from Zombieland Double Tap. It is the new film from Ruben Fleischer, and it stars Woody Harrelson, Jesse Eisenberg, Emma Stone, Abigail Breslin, Zoe Deutsch, Avon Joja, and Rosario Dawson. That scene, of course, features Zoe Deutsch as the new character, Madison.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep.
Didn't like her?
Well, you're not supposed to like her, so actually, well done.
I'm not sure if you're not supposed to like her.
Okay.
I think she's she's the third wheel.
Yeah.
In the proverbial quartet, but it's, you know.
I think it does point out one thing you have to... just sort of agree to watch this movie, which is that pretend the apocalypse happened yesterday because we're going to have like people who are from now. We're making fun of, you know, the type of person who is now, where like her character, all of her things, she would never still be that person if she had been living in a zombie apocalypse for the last like 7 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, well, that's...
Which you also have to accept that the power's just gonna... It just still works. Just don't even worry about
it. They explain that. The dam's just filled with water.
Yeah, food is all still fine, and cars that have had gas in the tank since people stop driving them, still work, and presumably they're somewhere where they get more gas. Just accept all of that and then sit back, which it took me some time to accept that. The power thing really bothered me. And then the fact that they even bothered to explain it so wrong, too, really kind of bothered me. But other than that, I was like, okay. I mean, it's a movie about zombies. Can I suspend my disbelief that there are zombies? Yes. So then I can also suspend it that the power just still works without anybody doing any work.
Yeah, it's not the world after people.
No.
It's but I mean, there's a very visible gag in it where Columbus is like reading a Walking Dead comic and he's like, this is so unbelievable.
Yes, sure is.
But at the same time, I gave up on The Walking Dead at some point because it's just like the nonstop nihilism of it. The nonstop, like, everyone these people run into, like, every time they run into another sect of human being, it is the worst possible type of human being. They are cannibals, or they are tin-plated dictators, or they're, like, just, like, outlaw gangs just, you know, pillaging and roving. It's like everyone they meet is horrible, and the people in the core group aren't necessarily saints themselves.
I certainly stopped after season three. I'm like, I get it. The humans are the monsters. I also get that about life.
Right.
That's why I like monster movies, because I know the humans are the monsters. Make the monster an allegory for our monstrousness instead of just...
Which is why, you know, I get your questions, and I also saw somebody online says, like, why is everyone so clean?
Yes. why is Madison so clean? That's the thing. Her clothes are spotless. Her hair looks great. She's got so much makeup on.
She also seems like she's been tanning.
She has been living in a mall, so she does have access to infinite, you know, outfits and clothes. I don't know where she's showering, though. Blow-drying her hair, that sort of stuff. But,
Yeah. Well, I mean...
But it's
Not to dig too far into the weeds, but, you know, some malls do have fitness clubs.
So. It's true, they do. That's a good point. Fair.
All right.
Okay.
But, you know, keeping that in context, when you get to a lot of these zombie movies, you're right. It's all about, like, the humans are the monsters and the zombies, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, I get that. But it's nice that we have a movie that takes place in the zombie apocalypse and nobody is, like, worrying about... you know, falling into traps because people live there and want to cannibalize you.
Yeah.
And
no,
you
know, I mean,
there's no, I can't remember the guy from The Walking Dead who was like the dictator guy.
Negan?
Well, there's several of them. But Negan is a good one. Yeah. It's just like that, you know, these are people who are essentially human.
Like
the apocalypse, like I feel like if the apocalypse comes, you're not going to get a lot of Negans.
No,
because people
in this world,
are still essentially good.
Essentially, Luke Wilson is the worst sort of human bad guy of this film. And what's so bad about him? Nothing.
Yeah, you would get a lot of Tallahassees, a lot of these like prepper types who like think they're John Wayne and you know, waiting to happen, just waiting for the right circumstance for the inner John Wayne to come out. So I think that's as low as we go, but. I'm willing to just sort of sit back and watch the movie where it's like, you know what the monsters are. They're the zombies. Yeah. And the fun is sort of watching how all these people not only navigate the broken world, but also navigate themselves and their interpersonal quirks.
Yeah, I mean, really, that's sort of the whole point of this movie. And I did actually prefer this one to the first one.
Oh, okay.
Because the first one I found, you know, even though it was a comedy and lighthearted, it was really about, like, survival, which, you know, that can be funny, apparently.
Yes,
but this
one
wasn't really about survival. It was really about relationships and family and building, like, you know, are the people we are with actually the people that we are best suited to be with in any sort of relationship, whether it's friendship, love, you know, familial, that sort of thing. And, you know, that I think that was kind of nice. I liked that part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, like, you know, as you say, like, Tallahassee is really a father figure. And, like, he's not. Like, he's not a father figure. But yet in this film, you're like, oh, but I understand how, even though, like, he claims to be a loner and, like, you know, he's sarcastic and cynical, but he cares.
Mm-hmm.
More than he would like to say.
Yeah, I mean, you're only a loner in context of, you know, there being other people around. And, you know, how are you a loner in a world where there actually are so few people? And that that's, you know, it seems like one of those like bravado things, like, oh, I'm a loner, and which, you know, makes, you know, reread into it that he can't really be a loner if he wants, if he's like spent so much time just hanging around with these three other people.
Well, and the first film sort of proves the point that, you know, the best way to survive is actually with other people. Mm-hmm. And this film sort of touches on that a little bit again, but not that much.
No, it's not a philosophical piece, but I mean, it's fun when you think about where this movie, where the first movie was in 2009. Mm-hmm. Emma Stone was a relatively new face. Mm-hmm. Jesse Eisenberg was a relatively new face. Abigail Breslin had done, I think she had done Little Miss Sunshine, and she was already Oscar nominated. But then Woody Harrelson, the establishment guy, that, you know, to come forward 10 years. Now Abigail Breslin is a young woman. Emma Stone has an Oscar. Mm-hmm. Jesse Eisenberg has been busy. Let's say he's been busy. But, you know, and Woody Harrelson, that probably endeared himself more, maybe even more of a star than he was back then. Yeah. He's always been a pretty big star. So, you know, to bring these sort of like four random people together, having, you know, grown and gone along different paths, especially considering the chemistry they had in the first one, and how do they fit back together well? And they do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's impressive that, you know, it's still... And then you can introduce new elements like Rosario Dawson and like Zoe Deutsch and the Berkeley guy.
Oh, my.
Or Luke Wilson and Tom Middleditch. And you know, even though I found the scene where they're comparing rules, that
went on just a little too long.
Yeah, that was a little much.
Yeah.
But that you can still throw in the new elements into it, and it. You can still hold on to the core, and they're still really good together. And so much so that I think you can walk out and say, you know what? I wouldn't mind seeing a Zombieland 3, whether it's in like another 10 years or.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't know. I enjoyed the first one. It was fine, but I had no interest in like, I didn't want another one.
Yeah,
it was announced, and I was like, well, you know, whatever.
It was fine.
It's fine. But then, you know, I did go see it, and I'm like, oh, I did actually enjoy this one more than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that both these films suffer since Shaun of the Dead exists, and there will never be a zombie comedy that can
Well, it was the first, and then, you know, when you read it that way, it's like this is very much the American remake.
Sure, yeah.
I think what I found about this one is, and maybe this is because Ruben Fleischer's grown as a director, is that there's like some actually ambition to the action sequences.
Oh yeah,
like the action, like the one with where they're at the camper. And, and the zombies are coming in.
That was pretty tense.
That was a really tense scene. And that's the scene where we're introduced to, like, the quote-unquote T-800, the super zombie. Yeah. And that scene is like, it just won't die. They keep shooting it. It won't die. Unfortunately, they never really do anything with that idea, I found. But it was still a great sequence. And then the other sequence later at the Heartbreak Hotel, where it looks like it's done all in one. It's not done in all in one shot, but it looked like it did.
Yeah.
It was very well executed.
Yep.
And so I give Ruben Fleischer points for that, you know, it's not just about, you know, the zingers and the cast, but he took a step up in the action. And those two scenes in particular are very, very tight.
Yeah. I did worry because while the first, like the opening scene, the opening credits was great. It did look great. Had a great soundtrack.
Gets you right into the movie.
Yeah. And I really liked the way it was interacting with the actual credits, which was fun. It also sort of worried me a little bit because it is very gory. Very, very gory. And I was like, oh, is this just going to be like Zombieland 2, the gorier one? but it wasn't. You know, there were a few rather gory moments.
Yeah.
But in general, other than that very first opening bit, I didn't find that the action sequences did just rely on the extreme shock of gore.
Right. It's very, I guess, purposed, like pointed when they do deploy it. And I think I know a couple of scenes later on that you're talking about, that where they do get gory and they get specifically gory. Mm-hmm. Of course, I think if you have a gag reflex, effects, then, you know, maybe there are some, yeah, like not necessarily gory scenes, but, you know, if I know there are some moments who don't like watching other people barf on film.
It happens. It is very
smart in terms of how it deploys that stuff, though. It's not a gross out film. It's not an action film, but it balances those things very, very mm-hmm. carefully. I did like that. I'm not so big on the whole, when they were like revisiting gags, like the zombie kill of the year or whatever. Let's just move along. And then things like putting the rules up was these, you know, they like, I could do without that.
Yeah,
too.
No, we get it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the biggest callback.
Right. At the end.
Yes. But even like throughout
but
it.
But I enjoyed
too.
That, though.
Yeah. I did not, but that's okay. It's all right. I mean, I never found that particular piece of the first movie to be the best part of the movie, or the most, you know, and that is consistently the part that people keep going back to about the original Zombieland.
Right. But it was unexpected.
Sure.
But I mean, first of all, we're talking about the Bill Murray the spoiler in the first one where they go to Bill Murray's house and it turns out he's there and he's still alive. And I think that's another case where it's like, if you don't have that spoiled for you going in, it's you remember it as sort of like a bigger surprise. As mm-hmm. And I think it also depends on your degree of Bill Murray love as well. And I know he's not to everyone's taste, but
I do love Bill Murray, but I don't know. I feel like there's a difference between a callback or like a, you know, like, oh, everybody sort of loved this and we'll call it back. Like, it was sort of okay the first time they did it, but then a few too many times. I was like, you know, like either your movie can't stand on its own.
Right. Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Or, you know, find new gags mm-hmm. that aren't sort of dependent on that. Because, I mean, otherwise, it's a weird sequel where you don't necessarily have to have seen the first one. It does help. But, I mean, it almost can stand on its
own. Yeah, I think it can.
And as you said, it's not that gory either. I mean, it's rated R because mm-hmm. there's some F-bombs mostly. Yeah. And there is some violence, of course. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. And I wonder how much, because when the first Zombieland came out, zombies were very much a thing. Everybody was, like, making their own zombie film. And even, you know, indie filmmakers, that was your gateway, you know, like making your own zombie film. You know, 10 years later, it's like a brand. It's a whole brand with the Walking Dead franchise. It's other than The Walking Dead, and even The Walking Dead it's not as popular as it once was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what kind of statement can this make on a culture that is sort of less enamored with zombies? And I think, maybe inadvertently, it kind of makes it, because sometimes in the film, the zombies almost feel like an afterthought. It can almost just be like a comical version
absolutely.
Of The Road.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it does keep coming back to the zombies. When it does deal with the zombies, I'm not sure they really have anything to say about the genre or anything. It's just,
they're just a way for the characters to move forward in life, which is mm-hmm. what they have now, right?
Right.
Like, you know, and this is why I have always sort of enjoyed zombie films, and particularly Romero's, because they weren't really about the zombies. They are about who are we when we strip away a lot of the other things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I liked this movie better because I think that it dealt with that more. And that's actually the thing that I like about zombie films and or the horror genre in general.
Mm-hmm.
What they say about us as humans. And by the way, I would probably, I mean, Babylon went a little far, but I would probably be the type of person who would either live there or create and set up that sort of thing. Because me, I'm always fortify and rebuild. That's my zombie philosophy.
None of that, like, traveling hither and yon.
Nope.
Not, you wouldn't go to the White House? No.
I might go to Graceland, though. I mean, I think Rosario Dawson kind of actually has it. She's sort of like the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
She's like a loner survivalist, but who owns a motel.
and ransack Graceland.
Yeah.
I think that was implied.
She looks damn fine in this film.
Tell me when Rosario Dawson isn't
true.
Fine.
True, she doesn't. She's never not fine, but She's going to be on my, if I cosplayed, I'd cosplay that character list, but I don't cosplay.
All right. Good enough. We'll have to leave that there. We're going to wrap up the show by reminding you that if you would like to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app. I always say iTunes app. I'm so
iTunes
on brand.
Isn't even like...
I know, it's not a thing anymore,
podcast
is it?
Isn't a part of iTunes, yeah.
Moving on. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can subscribe on there. Find us on social media on Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. Candace, where can people find you?
I am all over the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48, where you can, I don't know, hear me talk about music and politics and occasionally books and things like that. I don't know.
What a ringing endorsement. I will be back tomorrow. Well, it'll be a repeat tomorrow on Open Sources Guelph at 5 p.m. because it was election day this week. So,
no post-election scrum?
Well, we're doing 5 hours on election night.
All right, that's fine.
All right. Find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to GuelphPolitico.ca, or you can find my Maleficent Mistress of Evil review on Nightmare on Film Street. So you can check that out, too. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'll be back with someone else next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.